Leave your name and address, and we will send you a support pack. Thank you for listening. You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com worldwide. Freedom is never free. We need your support today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. The number to call in during this live broadcast is 1-800-858-6582. If you have unlimited long distance or are calling from a cell phone, please use our toll number 1-559-733-5161. That's 1-559-733-5161. Thank you.
And welcome, everyone, to another edition of American Exposé. I'm Darren Weeks, your host for the next 2 hours, sitting in for Chris Gerner on this August 9th, 2004 edition of the broadcast tonight. Been off for a little bit, take a little time off, and went up north, and but I have a lot of information to be sharing with you tonight, and a lot of it pertains to weather modification and water, as water is a very important, it's a very important renewable resource, but we're being told today that water is a non-renewable resource, and our water supplies are limited. How could your water supplies be limited, folks, when the whole earth is filled with water? You know, but yet more and more we're seeing more created crises that are taking place that they're using to manipulate populations of people. And that's what this is all about, folks. That's what this show is all about. We're exposing American Exposé. We're exposing the plan of the enemy in hopes that people will pay attention, wake up, and educate themselves so that they can educate others, because that's really the only hope that we have, is spreading the word and telling people so that everyone can rise up and instruct their legislators and their elected officials, as well as those who are even bureaucrats, folks. If enough people get angry at bureaucrats, they will back down, because you know what? They're scared. And that's one reason why they want to disarm us, is because they fear the wrath of the population of people. That brings us, first of all, to an article that appeared in China Daily. This was July 20th of 2004. Nations team up on arms control. We have the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency here in the United States, and nations are teaming up to control weaponry, and they're doing it, downsizing the military, but they're coming after your guns as well, folks. That's what they want to do. They want to take the guns out of the populations of people, and thank God we have a Second Amendment still in this country, even though they're pretending that the Constitution doesn't exist. Yet, in the minds of the people, the Constitution is still very relevant, and it's going to take quite a bit of conditioning for them to change that reality. But this piece says, as terror groups, and of course everything is done in the name of terrorism today, as terror groups' access to weapons of mass destruction have become more of a major threat to world security, you know, nobody ever cares about national security more. It's all about the world security. What is world security, folks? Can anyone answer that? 1-800-858-6582. I talked to Aaron at the top of the show. You can call in if you want. If anybody has an answer to that question, what is world security? They're saying that terror groups' access to weapons of mass destruction have become more of a major threat to world security. Well, as that's happening, supposedly, China is teaming up with other countries, such as the United States, to improve global non-proliferation, Vice President Minister Zhang Yusui said. He said his remarks at the opening ceremonies of a two-day Fifth Sino-U.S. Conference on Arms Control, Disarmament, and Non-Proliferation that opened Tuesday, and again, this is back on the 20th of July, so it's a little bit ago. In Beijing, Zhang said China has already participated in the Nuclear Suppliers Group, NSG, and is willing to take part in the Missile Technology Control Regime. He said China has formulated and enacted a number of laws and regulations, I'll bet they have, which form a complete system for export controls on nuclear, biological, chemical, missile, and other sensitive items in technologies. Looking back on cooperation between China and the United States on such issues as anti-terrorism, chemical and biological weapons, mines, and small weapons, Zhang noted that the Taiwan question is at the core of Sino-U.S. relations, and a most delicate one. He said, "We hope the United States adheres to the three joint communiques and does not send any wrong signals to Taiwan separatists. It relates to the peace and stability of the Taiwan Straits and the bilateral ties of China and the United States," he said. William Potter, director of the Center for Nonproliferation Studies, see, they got all these think tanks. Center for Nonproliferation Studies at U.S.-based Monterey Institute of International Studies said the U.S. and China should work more closely in fields such as conquering nuclear terrorism, which has imposed great threats to the United States and most of the other countries, including China. He also suggested the two countries put additional efforts in strengthening the Treaty on the Nonproliferation of Nuclear Weapons and promoting disarmament and nonproliferation education. Lui Jiayi, I can't pronounce these names, director of the Department of Arms Control and Disarmament with the Foreign Ministry, said China and the United States are both nuclear countries and share many common interests in arms control and nonproliferation. What is this all about, folks? I mean, the article goes on from here, but this is about disarming nations of people. It's about disarming you, because ultimately, when you have a situation where your country is disarmed, you're defenseless. A country which does not have a military, a country which does not have weaponry, is a country that cannot be sovereign. And that's the bottom line. If you don't have the method by which you can defend yourself, you do not have the method by which you can be sovereign. And that's what this is all about, folks. And the fact that our leaders, if you can call them that, that they're really traitors, the fact that they would take part in something like this indicates to you that they have every intention of driving this country as far into the ground as possible. Not that any of you who are in the know should have any doubt about that anyway, because anybody who's done any research into this, all of these issues that we deal with on this network, none of you should have any doubt about that. But in case I'm conscious of the fact that we probably have new listeners all the time. And disarmament is about, and just like disarming the country takes away your ability as a country to be sovereign, disarming the individual takes away from the individual's ability to be sovereign. As Sarah Brady of the Brady Bill was quoted from the National Educator, Volume 25, Number 8, January 1994. She said, our task of creating a socialist America can only succeed when those who would resist us have been totally disarmed. And make no mistake about it, that's what their goal is. Catherine Von Tour, who was a woman who used to be a liberal, she's written about her conversion. She says, most people who support the Second Amendment have probably wondered at one time or another how to change the mind, the thinking of anti-gunners. She says, since I was once a staunch gun control proponent, including being a member of Handgun Control Incorporated in the 1970s, she says, I am today a fervent and virtually no compromise Second Amendment supporter. Perhaps the story of my mental shift will be of interest. She said, when I recall my mindset in the 1960s, when I was in college in Chicago, and in the early 1970s, when I was teaching grade school in a private school in Pennsylvania, what I remember most is how completely convinced I was that government was the best and ultimate answer to all of society's ills: war, poverty, crime, and injustice. She says, I was a true 60s liberal who protested the Vietnam War. Well, folks, the Vietnam War should have been protested. the Vietnam War. What was the purpose of, can anybody tell me what the purpose, tell you what, if you know what the purpose of the Vietnam War was, call me, 1-800-858-6582, 800-858-6582. Tell me what the purpose of the Vietnam War was. Was it to drive out the communists? Well, that's what we're told it was. But the reality is they put so many restrictions on the soldiers. You can't fight a war with your hands tied, folks. And that's effectively what they were doing back in Vietnam. My thinking is that the purpose of the Vietnam War was to disenfranchise the military, to demoralize the military. She says, I was a true 60s liberal who protested the Vietnam War, sported a question authority bumper sticker. Again, you should question authority. That's the problem. Americans don't question authority. You should ask questions. She says, I sported that on my Volvo. She says, I was a charter member of the National Organization for Women and a charter subscriber to Ms. Magazine. I voted for George McGovern. I hung out with other earnest liberals, many of whom were also members of NOW. It wasn't that I believed government was perfect, far from it, but I had a blind faith that with enough effort and money, it could be made so. My idea of a perfect government, she said, was one which had a generous welfare program, free Medicare for all, lots of benign and helpful social programs, and government-mandated fairness and equality for all. I joined NOW because it promised to fight for equality under the law for women. It encouraged women to empower themselves and to be independent. Since I was a single woman, all these sounded like sensible ideas to me. She says, I joined Handgun and Control Incorporated because it had convinced me that guns were the root cause of violence and crime and that only criminals owned and used them. Well, she says, I had grown up and stationed with my family overseas and had been sent to private boarding school in Honolulu, where my family is from, and then went to Chatham Hall, a young ladies' finishing school in Virginia. Most of my life I've been protected and privileged. While my family didn't have a lot of money, we somehow gave the illusion that we did, since we lived overseas, complete with servants and first-class travel paid for by my father's company. I had been raised, as my mother put it, to be a lady. And certainly ladies in our social circle weren't trained in self-defense, particularly self-defense involving firearms, which in any case were completely banned in the countries where we lived. Are you listening to this, folks? They were completely banned in the countries where we lived. Thank God we have a constitution left in America. After graduating from Northwestern and doing graduate work at Lehigh, I got a job teaching sixth grade at a private day school in Pennsylvania where I stayed for 10 years, during which time I was an earnest and unwavering liberal. It was during this time that I joined Handgun Control and NOW and crusaded loudly and vociferously against violence, intolerance, and unfairness. Well, after 10 years of teaching, she says, I was still making very little money and had burned out. I decided to move back to Hawaii, which was my home, and where my parents had retired 25 years after 25 years of being stationed overseas, and purchased a franchise of skincare and cosmetic business whose products were sold through home shows. I spent 5 ghastly years in Honolulu struggling to run a business in a government climate which was socialistic and larded with welfare and social programs as any I had previously worked towards, those five years, she said, were the undoing of my liberalism. I tried in vain to recruit women who were on welfare to work, to do home shows, and make money by being independent, but I could in no way compete with the obscenely generous welfare benefits they were receiving for staying home and doing nothing, except in many cases growing marijuana, which they had plenty of time to do, since all of their needs were more than being met by the state. The Hawaii State Labor Board delivered the fatal death blow to my business by declaring that all of the independent contractors who worked for my company, for whom I could hardly convince to work at all, were to be classified as employees, and that I had to pay unemployment workers compensation and health care for them. The government cared not a whit that there was no money in my company to fund this state-sponsored state-mandated largesse. I was forced to close down the business, to file bankruptcy, and I moved back to the mainland, my formerly liberal tail between my legs, a newly hatched libertarian conservative. If you lined up the people who had similar stories like this, she says, I no longer saw government as the solution to social problems. It certainly hadn't solved mine, nor had it encouraged my trying to create jobs for the people of Hawaii, jobs which they didn't want to do because it was too much work, even though the Honolulu Star Bulletin was filled almost every week with whining letters from people complaining that there were no jobs to be had and imploring the governments to create more jobs. With the fervor and passion I had previously reserved for trying to get the government to expand its powers and programs, I began to read the writings of conservative and libertarian authors, and she names a bunch. I also plunged into the writings of the founders of America, Thomas Jefferson, Franklin, Madison, Paine, George Mason. I started meeting people who had also been abused by government agencies, the police, customs, DEA, IRS, and others. I started hearing stories of people having property seized without due process, and of people calling 911 and not having the police show up in time. But the pivotal turning point for her, she says, was the Los Angeles riots. She says, I was living in Orange County at the time, but had to go up to L.A. regularly on business. At the time, there had been a rash of violent carjackings, many of them committed against women who were driving alone. A friend, who knew a great deal about guns and had grown up around them, told me that because I was a woman, living and driving alone, he wanted me to start carrying a pistol in my car. He lent me a .38 Special and showed me how to load and unload and fire it. One day, just before the riots exploded, I was driving in downtown Los Angeles in a scary part of town. It was dusk. As I stopped at a red light, with one car in front of me, two men who had been watching me began quickly and menacingly approaching my car from the sidewalk. One of them was carrying a tire iron. I grabbed the pistol, which I had laid on the seat beside me, and held it up so that they could see it. The look in their eye changed in an instant, from threatening to fearful, and they immediately turned around and ran in the opposite direction. The light changed. I drove away. No one was hurt, but a gun in my formerly liberal hand had, I believe, probably saved my life, or at least prevented me from likely injury. L.A. riots turned anti-gun advocates into pro-gun supporters. Within a week, the very street where this incident happened had erupted in rioting, looting, and killing. I watched on television as the Korean grocers defended their property with AK-47s and AR-15s, and thus prevented it from being torched and looted. The police couldn't stop the violence. The police couldn't stop the violence and killing. I had friends who worked in the garment district in L.A. who barely made it out alive, and who told tales of pulling out pistols and having would-be attackers turn tail and run away. Guns were saving lives and property. As the riots threatened to spill over into Beverly Hills, myriad Hollywood types stormed gun stores. Are you listening to this, folks? As the riots threatened to spill over into Beverly Hills, a bunch of Hollywood people stormed the gun stores to arm themselves, only to be told that there would be a 15-day waiting period. Radio talk shows boiled with people calling in and screaming about how unfair this was, and how the law was leaving them helpless. Some of them even admitted that they had previously supported the waiting period and that they were now furious that it left them unarmed. That's, she goes on to say she joined some phony controlled opposition groups, which she didn't know they were controlled. The bottom line is, folks, this is the danger. This is the danger of supporting, there's an old saying that says, be careful what you ask for, because you just might get it. All of these people, and many of them, folks, many of them are just ordinary people who just, guns feel bad. It doesn't feel right. So you know, yes, make no mistake about it, folks, guns are dangerous. But that's the whole idea. Guns, when used properly, they save more lives than they ever take. You understand me? And folks, we don't ever hear about the countless incidents that happen every single day across this country. The countless times that guns actually save lives. They're not always printed. They're often not printed in the paper because nobody died. In fact, many times the authorities were never called because there was no need to call the authorities. There was no need to call the police. People were able to handle it on their own. So the papers and the authorities never even hear about the countless times. All you hear about is the time where some careless gun owner might have left the gun out and some little child shot himself. But you never hear about anything about the countless times, I shouldn't say never, because you do sometimes. But guns save lives, folks. And this is just another incident, another case. And I again, Sarah Brady, our task of creating a socialist America can only succeed when those who would resist us have been totally disarmed. And that should be all you need to know. Moving along, there's other things happening in the world. I just thought it was important to share that with you. We have a situation with Iraq going on right now. More people dying all the time in Iraq. I think it's interesting because we were told at the start of that whole thing, we were told we were going to liberate the people of Iraq. We were going to rescue them from a mad dictator, which Saddam Hussein probably was a mad dictator. But are the people better off today than they were back then when Saddam Hussein was in power? That's the question you need to ask yourself. And here I got a piece in front of me, which is written by WorldNet Daily. I do not support WorldNet Daily. Don't endorse them. However, I have validated this information with other sources, so I'm going to read it to you. Red flags fly over Baghdad. Iraqi communists get U.S. support in role in new interim government. It says the Iraqi Communist Party is strongly represented in the new interim government in Baghdad and is getting U.S. taxpayer support thanks to a U.S. group led by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. No group in Iraq, they say, was more vociferous in its celebration June 28th of the transition of power from the U.S.-led coalition than the Iraqi Communist Party. Outside the party's office in Baghdad, a dancing, cheering crowd waved red flags as sympathetic passing motorists sounded their horns. Iraq's biggest left-wing party has received a surprising amount of support and credibility. Are you listening to this? This is what your federal government did, folks, with your tax dollars. Now, if this doesn't make you mad, then, folks, nothing will make you mad. Iraq's biggest left-wing party, the Iraqi Communist Party, has received a surprising amount of support and credibility even while U.S. troops fight Islamic terrorists and remnants of Saddam Hussein forces. What's a terrorist? Anyone who disagrees with them. That's what a terrorist is. Don't think that you won't be labeled a terrorist someday because you speak out against tyrannical government. While the Iraqi Communist Party welcomed Saddam Hussein's removal from power, it opposed the war that made it possible, arguing the diplomatic means had not been exhausted. The communists pressed for inclusion in the interim government, a body created by the U.S. One U.S. supporter of the ICP has been the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs, a private taxpayer-funded group led by Madeleine Albright. At present, Leslie Campbell explained, and Leslie Campbell is from the NDI Middle East Director. She says, At present, the ICP boasts the most significant organizational structure among all the secular parties. Yes, so we put the communists in power because, well, they're organized. The ICP's General Secretary Hamid Majid Musa sits on the preparatory committee on the national conference to be convened later this month, which in turn will select advisors to the interim government. Around 10% of the conference delegates will represent democratic secular leftists, which in Iraq's fractured political landscape constitute a significant bloc. The Communist Party of Iraq, Hazb-e-Dib al-Shuuyi al-Iraq, was formed in 1934. They've been around since 1934. Over the years, the party has experienced a political roller coaster ride as an underground organization, a legitimate political force, and then again in the underground as members were being viciously hunted down by that mad dictator. That's right, Saddam Hussein. The Iraqi communists were being hunted down by Saddam Hussein. So what do? We go and get rid of Saddam Hussein so that the communists can be free to rule the country. And you folks think you live in a non-communistic country? Iraqi communists cooperated over the years with a number of Iraq regimes, including from time to time even the Ba'ath Party. The last period of cooperation with Ba'ath ended in 1979, with the party going again underground. By 1993, another communist party, the Workers' Communist Party of Iraq, joined the scene and linked with the Iranian Communist Party, another force. Well, gee, is the Iranian Communist Party going to be in power in Iran once we go in there and bomb those people to smithereens? Another force has been the Kurdish Communist Party. At times it is difficult to differentiate between the origins and statements and actions, and in the eyes of their opponents, they are all labeled with one term, Iraqi Communist. The Workers' Party, the Workers' Communist Party of Iraq has stronger relations with the Kurds and with the Iranians. Iraqi communists at times actually assisted in hostile countries such as Iran, especially during the long Iran-Iraq War of the 1980 to 1988, according to this bulletin. The Workers' Communist Party of Iraq cooperated with Kurdish rebels and communists in Kurdistan. All branches formed their own militias, some fighting alongside the Kurds and later on with the Iranians. A former Iraqi communist now living in North America described the party's activities during those years as the communists made an art of walking between raindrops and coming out dry. With the reemergence of the party across the country, one can understand the meaning of that description. Apparently, this political survival ability is being demonstrated once again. While the U.S.-led coalition is trying to adjust to the reality of growing urban and rural guerrilla campaigns, the communists were quick to utilize their experience in the diverse Iraqi society. In today's situation, old contracts and underground experience are their main advantage over the numerous new parties trying to enter the political arena. The Iraqi communists have always been successful in concealing internal and ideological power struggles between their various factions. This fact leads to confusion around the question of who is who in the Iraqi communist camp. Intelligence analysts say the communists were, in the eyes of the Ba'ath regime, a major threat because of their success in building an underground network, which from time to time stung the Hussein regime. A common description of the communists in the streets of Iraq, especially within the large Shiite community, is they know how to hide their hammer and sickle under the Ayatollah's headdress. In other words, communist activists who for years were forced to work in the underground can, if necessary, act as pious Shiites. I heard the tone. Folks, you're listening to American Exposé. I'm Darren Weeks. We're talking about communism in Iraq. By the way, this is the August 9th, 2004 edition of the broadcast. I think I forgot to mention that at the top. We're going to take a break here for just a moment, and we'll return on the other side of the break. Again, you're listening to American Exposé. Go to the website, AmericanExposé.com. American spelled with a K and not a T. And we'll be back momentarily.
in the world is going on? Stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com to find out first. And on satellite at Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70. What should the true Christian response to the homosexual marriage license debate be? It should be the same response that Christians should have had to marriage licensing in the first place. The very definition of a license demands that we not obtain one to marry. Black's Law Dictionary defines license as the permission by competent authority to do an act which, without such permission, would be illegal. We need to ask ourselves, why should it be illegal to marry without the state's permission? More importantly, why should we need the state's permission to participate in something which the Creator himself instituted? We do not need the state's permission to marry. What if you apply and the state says no? You must understand that the authority to license implies the power to prohibit. A license, by definition, confers a right to do something. The state cannot grant the right to marry because it is a God-given right. Should homosexuals have the right to obtain a marriage license? Let them grovel before their God, the state, for permission to do that which is unlawful in the eyes of the Creator. What should we do? Christian couples should not be marrying with state marriage licenses, nor should ministers require them. Some have said, if someone is married without a marriage license, then they won't really be married. Given the fact that states may soon legalize same-sex marriages, we need to ask ourselves, if a man and a man marry with a state marriage license, and a man and a woman marry without a state marriage license, who's really married? In reality, this contention that people are not really married unless they obtain a marriage license simply reveals how statist people are in their thinking. We need to think biblically. You should not be required to obtain a license from the state to marry any more than you need one to be a parent, which in some academic and legislative circles are currently pushing to be made law. But that is another topic. This free speech moment has been brought to you by FirstAmendmentRadio.com. If you can hear my voice, you are listening to the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network. If you would like to continue hearing these programs, there are several ways that you can help. One, you can make a donation or subscribe to your favorite program by going to FirstAmendmentRadio.com on the Internet and follow the instructions there. Two, you can sponsor your favorite program with your business advertising dollars or spend your dollars with those businesses that advertise on your favorite programs. Three, simply call in on live programs and tell them that you are listening on FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Now anyone can do that one. You can find the call-in numbers on our schedule pages at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. And finally, you can call 559-733-5002 and leave your name and address, and we will send you a support pack. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to American Exposé. I'm Darren Weeks, your host here, as we continue on here on this August 9th, 2004 edition of the broadcast. And once again, Chris's website is www.AmericanExposé.com. American is spelled with a K and not a C. AmericanExposé.com, and we encourage you to go there, and there's a lot of really important research information there. A lot of good stuff, including some weather modification and water-related stuff, which we're going to get into shortly here, because, folks, water is a very important thing, and you can use... There's certain things that you have to be able to continue living, and food is one of them, and... The United Nations already has plans to use food. I forget the lady's name. She's the director of the United Nations World Food Program. I think she was with the Federal Department of Agriculture. Bettini or something like that, Catherine Bettini, something like that. She said food is power. She says we use it to control behavior. She says some may call it bribery. She says... we do not apologize. See, they're not above using food and water and various things that you need, you have to live. They're not above using those things to control you. to get you to comply with whatever they want you to do. And those of you who have been listening a while, you certainly understand that. But we're talking about communism in Iraq right now. We're talking about the Iraqi people supposedly being liberated, and yet they have communists that have been invited by the U.S., apparently, to serve in their government. And this piece continues. It says, the communist network includes ties to other Iraqi ethnic groups. They are known to have excellent connections with the Assyrian and Chaldean minority and with the Kurds. Their ties with Kurdish communists were boosted and became significant following the first Gulf War and the creation of the Kurdish enclave in the north. One of the questions following the resurfacing of the communists is where the funding comes from. This question is of particular interest since the old Soviet Union is gone. Well, those of you who are regular listeners, you know that's a lie. The Soviet Union has been renamed. Communism is not dead in the Soviet Union. That's just for our consumption that they say the Soviet Union is gone. And this also, by the way, tells you where WorldNet Daily is coming from, because they're helping to promote this lie by saying the Soviet Union is gone. The answer is that financial support comes from diverse sources, all of which are anti-West, particularly anti-American. Most are linked to global interests, which do not coincide with those of the U.S. Intelligence analysts say European communist parties are responsible for some of the funding, but countries such as North Korea and Iran are at the forefront of funneling funds to their preferred communist branches. Iran has a long-standing obligation to the Workers' Communist Party of Iraq for its support, including providing vital intelligence during and after the Iran-Iraq War. The North Koreans are interested in pinning down Iraq as many U.S. troops as possible to keep them away from the Pacific and the Far East. In addition, funds are being funneled by Syria as part of her anti-U.S. agenda. Other funds come from large communist parties in Asia, predominantly from India. Interesting. Some intelligence analysts familiar with Iraqi politics suggest that at this point, Ba'ath activists might even funnel funds to their communist rivals, aiming at strengthening them for the moment. They will use any and every avenue to pose more problems for the U.S. A review of the Iraq political scenario reveals growing discontent among former army and government officials, many of whom are now unemployed due to the policies of the coalition administration. Many realizing the coalition has not prohibited communist activities are opting to start a new political affiliation. The communists continue to conduct many of their clandestine organizational and planning activities outside of Iraq, as far as possible from the coalition's grip. They have no problem of communication, organizing meetings, and planning their strategy as they prepare for the possibility they may have to hit the streets to fight for their agenda. Intelligence sources say the coalition should expect that, following the reemergence of the Red Banner and the new face, the communist parties will in due course reveal their claws, demanding what they believe is their historic right and mission to be at the helm. I want to read that again. Intelligence sources say the coalition should expect that following the reemergence of the Red Banner and the new face, the communist parties will in due course reveal their claws, demanding what they believe is their historic right and mission to be at the helm. The NDI has won bipartisan praise for its work in the former Soviet bloc, and the developing world, but by supporting the ICP, insiders say, the NDI is embarrassing itself and the United States. Some senior Iraqi communists have publicly suggested to their loyalists that they were prepared to use violence against U.S.-led coalition forces and that they were organizing front groups and infiltrating civil organizations across Iraq to gain political power. While appearing to cooperate publicly, the ICP Central Committee wrote a letter to its faithful in October 2003 explaining that it would use its position on the Governing Council to wage political warfare from within to complement its fight from the outside. Our party, the letter said, has regarded the Council as an area of struggle rather than being a final, fixed, definitive authority. Our party can play a more influential role from within this process to push in the required direction while struggling from without to mobilize the people to effectively ensure that the process develops in the right direction. It is, in this sense, an area, an arena of struggle, because diverse forces and sides are influencing the political process both inside and outside the Council. But NDI seems to treat the Communists as a representative voice of secular Iraqis. The group issued an on-site assessment report in July 2003 that stated, when asked if the Military or Coalition Provisional Authority, the CPA, should withdraw from Iraq, most people expressed a sentiment similar to the one we heard from a former Secretary General of the Iraqi Communist Party. If the CPA were to withdraw from Iraq, there would be a civil war and Democrats would have no chance. On April 10, 2003, the day after U.S.-led coalition forces toppled Saddam Hussein, the ICP issued a statement denouncing the Americans, demanding an immediate halt to the war and ending U.S. unilateralism. Musso told the radical Italian paper, Something Manifesto, in June, if the U.S. wants stability for the country, then it should accept our solution. And if they don't agree, the manifesto questioner asked, would you then be ready to fight? Musa avoided the question, replying, we are now acting in a legitimate and peaceful way. Although U.S. officials say the ICP has been behaving responsibly, they added that communists would be foolish to do otherwise. For the first time in its 70-year history, the ICP, again the Iraqi Communist Party, is able to operate freely throughout Iraq without fear of persecution. For the first time in its 70-year history, the Iraqi Communist Party is able to operate freely throughout Iraq without fear of persecution. Yes, isn't this wonderful how we've liberated these people? Well organized, well trained, and supported from abroad, the party maintained networks of clandestine front organizations inside Saddam Hussein's Iraq and abroad. It was the first to publish a regular newspaper after the U.S. liberation, quote-unquote. I put it in quotes, they didn't. Even as the coalition was struggling to establish a credible daily of its own. The ICP's organizational abilities has allowed the ICP to infiltrate new political and social institutions, including human rights groups, and provoke them to take and maintain an anti-U.S. position while benefiting from U.S. protections. How marvelous the work in Iraq. The ICP's comrade Ali told the Iranian Communist Tudeh Party, quote, a lot of effort has been put into rebuilding the democratic and trade union movement. Women, youth, and student organizations have emerged in the open after long decades of clandestine work, end quote. A senior Pentagon official said the Coalition Provisional Authority and U.S. aid lack the means to screen the ICP, Islamist agents, and other troublemakers from receiving taxpayer funds. Well, you know what? Too bad. We shouldn't be there in the first place. That's the whole point here, folks. We have no business over there. Period. It's pretty hard to screen them out when people in the middle of U.S. aid machinery want to bring them in, he said. So there you have it. Isn't it great to be an American? Aren't you proud to be an American? Meanwhile, we have Russia and China. Headline from the China Daily, Russia-China to enhance military co-op. We're pretending these people are our friends, folks. Meanwhile, they're building new alliances all the time. They signed a friendship treaty, a friendship agreement in 2001. Here we see from China Daily, July 9th, of this year, they're building a military alliance. Russia Prime Minister Mikhail Fedkov and Vice Chairman of China's Central Military Commission, Guo Boxsoing, met here Thursday to enhance development of bilateral relations. Fedkov said, "We have achieved a high level of military and technical cooperation." He added that the development of bilateral cooperation has a broad prospect. Russia is satisfied with the high-level relationship with China and attaches great importance to the development of bilateral ties, the Russian Prime Minister said. Fedkov expressed the belief, that the Russian-Chinese strategic partnership of cooperation will become more consolidated and mature. Zhuo noted that the strengthening the friendly cooperation between the armies of the two countries will contribute to the maintenance of regional and global peace and stability. China and Russia will be good neighbors and partners forever and make new efforts in promoting the strategic partnership, he said. Zhuo arrived in Moscow on Monday for a five-day official goodwill visit at the invitation of Russian Defense Minister Sergei Ivanov. So the cozy relationship continues there between Russia and between China. Other things, as the command and control structure continues, we see the United Nations aims to bring spam epidemic to end. Dateline Geneva, the United Nations is aiming to bring a modern-day epidemic of junk email under control within the next 2 years by standardizing of legislation around the world. There it is, folks, the standardization of legislation. And it's supposed to make it easier to prosecute for spamming people, a leading expert said Tuesday. We have an epidemic on our hands, Robert Horton, the acting chief of the Australian Communications Authority, told reporters. He says, "We need to learn how to control it. International cooperation is the ultimate goal. So it's the United Nations to the rescue." The International Telecommunications Union is hosting a meeting on spam in Geneva. This was the week of July 6th. So I guess that's over with now. But it's still important. That brings together regulators from 60 countries as well as various international organizations, including the Council of Europe and the World Trade Organization. The UN agency said it would put forward examples of anti-spam legislation which countries can adopt and make cross-border cooperation easier. Many states currently have no anti-spamming laws in place, making it difficult to prosecute the international phenomenon. Top priority is, quote, pornographic material that may come to the attention of children. Now, they always start with good intentions, don't they? They always start with something that people can get behind. Horton, who is running the meeting, says, "I think it's time we did something formally about this. We will have to come to some sort of general understanding. As much as 85% of all email may be categorized as spam," the ITU said, "compared to an estimated 35% just 1 year ago. The vast majority is generated by a few hundred people, but authorities are not able to prosecute many of them under current legislation. Spam and anti-spam protection cost computer users some $25 billion last year, according to the United Nations, who apparently is an authority on everything anymore. Notice how more and more the United Nations is being cited by various media sources as an authority. This is a non-governmental organization, folks. Why are we to believe the United Nations? They can come out with these statistics and the media just states them like they're gospel. And you wonder why you go somewhere and you mention that the United Nations is doing something bad and people look at you like you're weird. Well, this is why. Because the United Nations is being promoted heavily as a legitimate and credible source for information and authority and everything else. Now the problem is rapidly spreading to cell phones. It continues, 9 of every 10 spam messages in Japan are now directed to mobile phones as text messages, Horton said. Spamming is also being used to perpetrate criminal acts. One technique known as phishing involves sending emails that appear to be genuine correspondence from reputable companies. Recipients are asked for their bank details to clear up a mistake, and then money is bled from their accounts. Well, what are the unintended consequences of this going to be? Restriction of those who spread hate mail? What if you say something? What about this hate legislation? Hate crimes? Will that someday fall under these spam laws? I mean, anything's possible. And, I mean, they can already read your email. I mean, that's not even up for debate anymore, I guess. But the United Nations, basically the point there is that the United Nations is continually being promoted as a more credible agency by the controlled media. Speaking of the UN, more work on a global scale going on the climate stuff. United Nations Agenda 21 talks about us, our need to be sustainable. It's the blueprint for sustainable development. We have all 40 chapters of that, by the way, on AmericanExpose.com. American spelled with a K, not a C. AmericanExpose.com. You can go in the Agenda 21 section and read Agenda 21. But here we see experts issue climate alert. Experts issue climate alert. Researchers working on a study named SAIM-2, S-A-I-M-2, have this week following the publication of findings made in research that commenced in 1999 cautioned that Portugal could be facing serious climatic problems. Speaking at a conference in Lisbon on Wednesday, researchers made the forecast that Portugal could have temperatures in excess of 35 degrees for 75 days of the year in the not-too-distant future. Currently, they have averages between 10 to 15 days per annum, which reach 35 degrees plus temperatures. According to scientists responsible for compiling this exhaustive study, water shortages. There you have it. Water shortages, regular heat waves, increased coastal erosion and disease are some of the effects climate change could have in Portugal in the coming years. Researchers argue these changes are being expedited due to negative impacts being exerted on the energy sector and the dramatic rise in the use of air conditioners the past decade. It's funny because I remember Chris Gerner saying on this very broadcast, what was it now, a month and a half, 2 months ago, that air conditioners are not sustainable. They want to do away with your air conditioners because they're not sustainable in the eyes of these control freaks. And everyone knows that sustainable development is here, and they want to make everything sustainable. Members of the research team explained that while the study is aimed at looking at the midterm future, heat waves such as the one experienced last year and at the end of June this year would no longer be exceptions but rather become common occurrences. Now, how do they know this, folks? Who are these researchers? Who are these researchers and how do they know all this? Do they have a crystal ball? The study financed at the Gulbenkian Foundation, What's the Gulbenkian Foundation? And the Science and Technology Institute. Who are these people? Who funds them? What agenda do they have? And does anybody who reads an article like this, do they ask these questions? Most don't, unfortunately. But this underlies this whole story. This is the foundation of this whole story, is that these people at the Gulbenkian Foundation and the Science and Technology Institute are looking at this stuff and making these allegations. They indicate that energy peaks are starting to swing from winter months to the summer. This scenario could lead to hydroelectric turbines being exhausted due to water shortages, necessitating the use of other energy resources with far higher incidences of pollution. Researchers further stated that the sea level will rise 5 centimeters per decade in Portugal, reaching 50 centimeters by the end of the century. In addition, shorter rainy seasons are expected, where precipitation between June and September will only occur under exceptional circumstances. On a geographical scale, researchers stated that the Azores will suffer least as a result of climate change, while Madeira is likely to experience higher temperatures and reduced levels of rainfall. Despite the conclusions made in the second phase of the ongoing study, researchers say that Portugal still has a long distance to cover before a national climate change plan is implemented to introduce and enforce measures aimed at preventing and dealing with climate change in Portugal. A climate change plan. Interesting. What is that? What is a climate change plan? Implementing Agenda 21? Here we see, again from China Daily. Now this one's kind of interesting. Predicted rains signal flood and mudslide alarm. Heavy rain or thunderstorms are forecast to sweep over most parts of China Monday, raising new alarms for possible flooding, mud rock flows, and landslides, meteorologists said on Sunday. The rain belt should move over most parts of northeast China, the Yellow River areas, and Henshui River, and parts of the Yanhuai, Gaizu, I'm sorry, folks, I just can't pronounce these Chinese names. Plateau, said Yang Kimen, a senior engineer with the Central Meteorological Observatory. Yang said thunderstorms or torrential rains will pour down onto some parts of these areas with strong gusts. During the past weekends, most parts of North China, including Beijing, Tianjin, and the provinces of Hebei, Henan, Shenzhen, and East China's Shandong have received torrential rains and thunderstorms. Parts of the western regions, like Gansu province, and a whole bunch of others I'm not going to try to pronounce, were also included. Officials hope the rainfall will relieve the heat and drought in most parts of the northwestern Xinjiang, whatever. But anyway, Henan, this huge flooding is going on in China right now. And Henan is one of the ones that are included. Now, when we come back from the break, I'm going to share with you a report from the BBC News headline, China Rainmaking Creates a Storm. They talk again about cloud seeding. In this report from China Daily, they don't mention that this is going on. But, folks, could this flood have been caused by weather modification techniques going on in China? Stay with us. You're listening to American Exposé. We'll be back.